Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Deeper Than the Ocean by Julianne Walker. Narrated by Mackenzie Cartwright. Dream higher than the sky and love deeper than the ocean. Unknown. Prologue. June 27th, 1624. The end of the mangrove branch was as hard and as sharp as the devil's thumbnail when it tore into Captain Bartolome Vargas's cheek. Searing pain was followed by the feel of hot blood sliding down his sweaty face. He leapt over a knobby-knuckled tree root. 'Twas no easy task, given his legs burned with fatigue. Not so long ago, he could have sprinted from the bridge of Segovia to King Philip's court without losing his breath. Now, he was lucky to skirt a fat sea-grape bush without falling flat on his arse. His lungs were afire when he raked in a gasping breath of hot subtropical air. Thirst and starvation wreak havoc on the body, he thought desperately. And if his own sorry state was not enough to convince him, all he need do was look to Rosario, his stalwart midshipman. Rosario kept pace beside him, but a harsh wheeze issued from the depths of the young sailor's chest. The sunken, bruised flesh around Rosario's eyes spoke of restless nights made worse by the continuous grumblings of a hungry belly. And Rosario's lips were so dry and cracked. Bartolome's own mouth smarted in sympathy. Of the 224 brave souls who had set sail aboard the Santa Cristina on her doomed voyage, only 36 had survived the storm and subsequent wreck. In the weeks that had followed the early season hurricane and the sinking of the galleon, three more of Bartolome's crew had succumbed to illness and the elements. Now, if the French sailors from the small ketch that had dropped anchor beyond the reef, the ones who had rowed to shore and who were at that moment traipsing up the beach, happened upon them, Bartolome knew he would lose still more of his loyal men.
"What do we do, Capitan?"
Rosario held a grubby hand to the stitch in his side as they darted and weaved through the sand and trees toward the slapdash camp set up in the center of the tiny island they now called home.
"We hide."
Bartolome swiped at the hot, sticky blood dripping from his chin.
"And if they find us, we fight."
Rosario's Adam's apple lurched in the wind-burned column of his throat. Doubt flashed in his black eyes. Bartolome had counted 15 sailors aboard the newly arrived French vessel, which meant if it came to a battle, the crew of the Santa Cristina outnumbered the intruders more than 2-1. Even so, it was obvious the midshipmen held little faith they would come out the victors in any conflict with the newcomers. Bartolome shared Rosario's fear. The rest of his crew were in no better shape than he or Rosario. What we gain in numbers, we give up in strength. He considered commanding his men to surrender to the scurvy French bastards, to save themselves. The wreck had already taken so many souls, and that loss of life weighed heavy upon Bartolome's spirit. The thought of delivering more members of his courageous crew into the hands of the Reaper, 'twas almost too much to bear. And yet, if they turned themselves over, surely they would be keel-hauled, or worse, until they gave up the location of the Santa Cristina's enormous bounty. Bartolome and his men had not spent the last few weeks liberating the tons of gold and silver coins, the barrels of jewelry and uncut gemstones from the Santa Cristina's sunken carcass, simply to have it land in the hands of the French king. Louis XIII was el hijo de puta of high renown. Doubtless the vile monarch would use the Santa Cristina's riches to further the conflict already brewing between France and Bartolome's homeland of Spain. That could not happen. Not if Bartolome had breath left in his body. His midshipman was the first to burst into the dirty clearing where the Santa Cristina's surviving crew gathered around a small campfire, smoking the small batch of fish they had pulled from the sea earlier that morning. By the time Bartolome wrestled past the last bush, most of his men were on their feet, looking at him in alarm.
"Francis,"
he gasped, flinging more blood from his face and sparing it but a glance as it landed on the sand in a shower of shining crimson. After two deep breaths, he added,
"Grab your weapons."
To a man, the sailors scrambled to arm themselves with the rudimentary spears and clubs they had fashioned from downed limbs and the few pieces of sturdy driftwood harvested from the beach. A handful of them wielded the blades and daggers they had clung to during the perilous swim to shore after the big ship went down. Bartolome had prepared his men for the day they would be discovered by their enemies, for the day they would have to battle for their lives and the safety of the spoils meant to fund the might and continued glory of Spain. It seemed that day may have come. He took comfort in knowing the treasure was secure in its new home, and he held out a small spark of hope the Frenchmen would leave the island without venturing too far inland. That spark was doused, however, when raised voices sounded through the trees. As a child, he had found the French tongue beautiful, almost musical in tone and cadence. Now, it sounded to him as harsh and unforgiving as a clanging death knell.
"'Tis time," he thought gravely. "Time to dance with the darkness once again."
As King Philip's most decorated sea captain, he had seen his fair share of fighting and recognized the hot, oily anticipation of battle when it slicked through his veins. Habit had him reaching for his trusty cutlass, but his fingers landed only on the cracked leather of his belt. He had lost his prized blade in the storm.
"Here, Capitan."
A gunner by the name of Juan Jose handed Bartolome a bone-handled dagger.
"May the good Madre Maria be with you, sir." "May she be with each of us," Bartolome agreed with the firm dip of his chin.
He had barely spoken the last word when the group of Frenchmen stumbled into the clearing. Once the newcomers saw the haggard faces of the Santa Cristina's crew staring back at them, their expressions registered varying degrees of confusion and surprise. Then, understanding dawned in the eyes of the leader of the group. That understanding was quickly replaced by a prurient gleam.
"So, here you are,"
the man said in badly accented Spanish, rubbing a hand over his stubbled chin so his rough palm rasped against his whiskers. It reminded Bartolome of a snake in the grass, and he could not shake the feeling this newcomer might prove as deadly.
"Every ship that sails these waters has been looking for you since the storm, but fortune favors us, it would seem."
The French leader cocked his head, a slow, greasy grin slipping over his tanned leather face.
"Tell us where to find the treasure."
Bartolome brandished the dagger in his hand, squinting when a ray of sunshine cut through the trees overhead, making the blade sparkle with menace.
"We will die before we tell you,"
he growled through gritted teeth. The newcomer's gaze alighted on each of Bartolome's crewmen, no doubt taking their pitiful measure. For one long moment, no one moved. No one dared breathe. The tension vibrating through the air was thick enough to cut with a rapier. Finally, the French leader shrugged.
"So be it."
Lifting his blunderbuss, he aimed at Juan Jose's chest and pulled the trigger. The blast from the weapon was obscenely loud in the silence of the clearing, but it was nothing compared to the pain-soaked cry that pealed from the back of Juan Jose's throat when the young sailor was flung backward by the force of the large bore shot. He hit the sandy ground, his hands scrabbling ineffectually at the bloody, bony mess that had once been his sternum. For a few heartbeats, Juan Jose's brain refused to believe his body was already dead. But then reality set in, and the young gunner breathed his last. As his spirit left his body, his bladder emptied itself. The smell of rancid urine perfumed the air, making Bartolome's nostrils flare.
death is such an indignity, he thought as rage rolled through him. His voice was a crack of thunder when he bellowed, Attack! Bless his crew, they did not hesitate. Hurling themselves toward the newcomers, they fought with what little strength remained in their enfeebled bodies. Battle cries, the boom of weapons, and the clash of steel echoed through the trees. But Bartolome heard none of it. He was deaf to all but one man, the bastardo who had so callously killed Juan José. Bartolome's deadly intent must have registered on his face. When he charged the newcomer, he was met with a sneer and the zinging of a cutlass pulling free from its scabbard. He did not do as his instincts prompted and viciously attacked the man in a bid to slice him bloody. A dagger had no hope of defeating a cutlass in hand-to-hand combat, but what the small blade lacked in reach, it more than made up for in maneuverability. When he was but a few paces from his target, Bartolome flung the knife with all his might. The force of his throw caused two buttons on his tattered vest to pop off and fall into the sand, and the dagger spiraled through the dense air, silver and ivory mixing together in a pinwheel of color. The flight was silent. The end of the flight was not. The blade buried itself in the Frenchman's chest with a solid thunk. When the intruder saw the dagger had planted itself deep, his eyes flew wide. Bartolome could see the delicate web of veins cutting through the whites. The Frenchman wrapped a hand around the bone handle, but that was the last move he made before his eyes rolled back and he toppled sideways. Dark blood oozed from the corner of his open mouth to pool in the sand beneath his head. Bartolome might have taken a moment to bask in the precision of his throw, but a familiar voice cut through the cacophony of battle with a desperate cry for help. A quick glance to his left showed Rosario wrestled with a man twice his size. Without hesitation, Bartolome pulled the dagger from the lifeless body of the Frenchman. Letting loose with a banshee cry, he launched himself onto the back of the puto cabrón, pinning Rosario to the ground. Chapter 1 Present Day 4:45 p.m. Even a small mouse has anger. Ray Wolf Roanhorse's grandmother had used the saying to teach him that rancor was never a bad thing, but rather an emotion that everything from the tallest man to the tiniest rodent felt. It was how one dealt with it that mattered. Wolf stood still as a stone outside the weathered beach house on Wayfarer Island, dealing by keeping his damned mouth shut. What was the cause of his foul temper, you ask? It was twofold. First, after months of fruitless searching, he and his salvage partners had finally located the sunken remains of the legendary Santa Cristina. Praise the Lord and pass the ammunition. They'd pulled up a few religious artifacts, some ceremonial cups and crosses and rosaries. They'd stumbled upon a handful of weapons, a sword, two daggers, and one coral-encrusted musket. But the motherlode, the millions of dollars in coins and gold bars, the silver ingots and uncut emeralds clearly reported on the Ghost Galleon's manifest? Nothing. Nada. Zippo. Zilch. Which meant it was looking highly unlikely they'd recoup their life savings, which they'd invested in starting their deep six salvage business, much less strike it rich. Should have stayed in the Navy, he mused bitterly. Then again, he and his former SEAL team members had all been getting long in the tooth, and every spec ops guy worth his salt knew what that meant. Doesn't matter how good we were. And they'd been better than most. If we'd kept spinning that chamber, all of us would have eventually checked into the horizontal Hilton. In fact, it was already too late for one of them. Rusty Lawrence had been a tough, stubborn son of a bitch. His body had been riddled with bullets the day they dragged him out of a dusty compound in Aleppo after an op that had gone tits up. But he hadn't succumbed to the horror of his wounds,
before making all of them promise to wave goodbye to the lives of frogmen. Rusty had known he would be the first to go, and the bastard had done the one thing he could to make certain he was the last. Which meant when their contracts expired, none of the remaining 7 members of the Great Eight had re-upped. Instead, Michael Mad Dog Wainwright had returned to his hometown of Atlantic City to make babies with a saucy redhead, and the other 6 SEALs from their unit had traded sorties for scuba tanks, firefights for swim fins, and joined their lieutenant, a man by the name of Leo the Lion Anderson, in the search for the storied Santa Cristina, a prize treasure hunters had been after for centuries. Wolf and his SEAL brothers all had big plans for the cabbage they hoped to pick up from the salvage. Leo, or LT as they called him in a nod to his rank, wanted to buy Wayfarer Island, the small spit of land rising out of the Caribbean that his family had leased from the U.S. government way back when Ulysses S. Grant sat pretty at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. The same lump of sand and mangrove forest they all called home. Then there was Spiro Romeo Delgado, who leaned against the palm tree next to Wolf. Romeo planned to use his slice of the pie to start a charity in L.A. for kids like himself. Kids who had grown up on streets so mean that a run-in with drug addiction, gun violence, and rival gangs just meant it was a Tuesday. Mason Monet McCarthy hoped to buy a row house in Beantown and season tickets to the Red Sox. Brando Bran Palladino made noises about opening an Italian restaurant in his fiancée's hometown of Houston. And Dalton Doc Simmons had his eye on a ranch back in Montana. Then there was Wolf himself. His aims, though not so grandiose as buying an island or funding a charity, were of no less personal significance. You see, he had himself a trio of sisters, and each of them had worse taste in men than the one before. Wolf had read a quote somewhere once, "I view each and every one of your glaring red flags as a personal challenge," and he reckoned that summed up how his sisters went about choosing partners, which wouldn't have been a bad thing, except Rebecca, Roxanne, and Robin were also fertile as turtles. Between the three of them, they'd gifted Wolf with 10 nieces and nephews, a whole brood of roan horses, and not a single baby daddy offering up child support among them, which meant the cheddar needed for braces, baseball cleats, and college funds was nearly impossible to come by. Wolf had hoped to be the one to make it rain, had hoped to provide his sister's little crotch goblins with all the creature comforts he had done without while growing up on a scrubby piece of property outside Tahlequah, Oklahoma. But with every passing day, that hope dimmed. In fact, at this point, it was little more than a glimmer. Thinking of the women in his life who confounded him brought his thoughts around to the second thing giving him fits. Her name was Christina Zarek, Chrissy for short, and she was as long-limbed and blonde as her Polish surname implied. He'd had a thing for blondes ever since he was 5 years old and found himself in Miss Featherstone's kindergarten class. Miss Featherstone had reminded him of a sunflower, sweet and radiant. Then there'd been Dana Teague in the 6th grade, a bubbly soccer player with a pleasant smile and long, thick braids. She'd been followed by Keely Potter in high school. Keely had turned out to be a bottle blonde, a fact Wolf learned only after she let him get to third base under the bleachers at the football stadium. But none of those flaxen-haired sirens had ever made him want, quite like Chrissy did. Want what, though? That was the million-dollar question. Want her kisses? Certainly. I mean, have you seen her mouth? Want her long, curvy body stretched out beside him in bed? Undoubtedly. I mean, have you seen those legs? Want her cool, slim fingers running over his skin until he shivered and moaned and begged her to let him take her? You betcha. I mean, have you seen those hands? Still, there was something more he wanted from her. Something nebulous and shadowy he couldn't quite put a name to. All he could say for sure was that she was a pressure in his chest,
a void in his stomach, and a pain in my ass, because she breaks out the Heisman move every time I get close, he thought as he let his eyes travel over to her. Chrissy stood in the sand at the base of the beach house's front porch steps, her hands shoved deep in the pockets of her cut-off shorts as she listened to the gathered group discuss the Santa Cristina's missing motherlode. From the top of her messy ponytail to the tips of her unpainted toenails, everything about her screamed Islander. Thanks to hours spent on the water, her skin was tanned a light cognac. Her blue eyes glittered in the rays of hard subtropical sun, slanting down through the fronds of the palm tree overhead. And she'd paired her red bikini with a tank top that read, Key West, nearly perfect, far from normal. A simple silver bracelet with abalone charms in the shapes of sea life was her only jewelry. The charms tinkled quietly when she lifted a hand to tuck a stray lock of hair behind her ear. For the billionth time, he noted the simple grace and purity of her movements. They reminded him of the weeping willow that grew next to the cattle pond on his family's land, how it would sway when the wind preceding a summer shower swept over the plains. Sensing his scrutiny, she darted a look his way. The instant their eyes clashed, heat stole across his skin. The devil in him had him winking at her, but he wasn't sure she saw. She'd quickly returned her attention to the group. Oh, she saw, he thought a moment later, when a wash of pink that had nothing to do with the cloudless morning they'd spent diving down on the wreck stained her cheeks. She tried to act as if she was immune to his charms, as if keeping him in the friend zone didn't cost her a moment's work. But he'd spent the better part of his 34 years studying women, and he recognized the subtle signs they gave when they were attracted to him. Chrissy? She wasn't a subtle sign. She was blinking neon. So why the hell weren't they upstairs in his bedroom knocking boots, or flip-flops, as the case may be? Simply put, because he'd screwed the pooch. Royally. And it didn't matter she'd since forgiven him for the night that shall not be named, or that it had been an honest mistake to begin with, she still... Romeo pushed away from his languid lean against the palm tree to clap a hand on Wolf's shoulder. Hitching his chin toward Chrissy, the flyboy added, You went and caught all the feels. Admit it. Wolf hated being obvious. Then again, he'd read somewhere that honesty and transparency make you vulnerable. Be honest and transparent anyway. So, fine. He was being obvious. At least I ain't the only one. I'll admit I caught feels for Chrissy, he muttered from the corner of his mouth, when you admit you're catching feels for Mia. He shot a finger gun toward the woman, gesturing excitedly and saying, I know you're all disappointed not to have found the Santa Cristina's cargo, but stop for a moment to appreciate what you have found. This site is a time capsule. We're getting a first-hand look at what life was like 400 years ago aboard a sizable seafaring vessel. According to state and federal law, when a salvage crew stumbled upon a wreck, they were required to bring in a marine archaeologist to catalog the site and oversee the excavation. Enter Mia Ennis, a strawberry blonde with a penchant for avocados and expensive skincare products. 2 hours after they'd hauled up the first of the Santa Cristina's bronze deck cannons, they'd contacted the state of Florida to report their find. 36 hours later, Mia had landed on their doorstep with bags in hand. In the nearly 4 weeks since, she'd not only become part of their crew, she'd become part of their family. Wolf supposed that was inevitable given they were military men, honor-bound to protect those softer than themselves. And Mia Ennis? She was the gentlest, most soft-spoken woman he'd ever met. Not to mention, there was a broken quality about her. He wasn't sure what tragedies marred her past, or if her quiet disposition was simply a part of her nature. He just knew the only time she raised her voice much above a whisper was when she talked about the excavation site. And the only time her eyes lit with an inner fire was when she was inspecting the artifacts they hauled up from the seabed.
or when she looked at Romeo. There was no mistaking the way her cheeks heated and her pupils dilated whenever the sailor cum pilot cum salver entered the room. Speaking of the sailor cum pilot cum salver, maybe I am catching feels for the marvelous Mia Ennis, Romeo admitted with a laconic half-smile. You think she'd be interested in a former fighting man like me? Wolf considered the marine archaeologist for a few seconds more before whispering to Romeo, Actually, I think she probably only dates men with IQs in the double digits. Navy SEALs never passed up an opportunity to feed each other heaping helpings of shit. And it didn't matter that neither he nor Romeo wore the gold trident pin of the Brotherhood anymore. Once a SEAL, always a SEAL. Guess that counts us both out then, eh? Romeo winked, not one to be outdone. It's just as well, he added with a dramatic sigh. She's too good for me anyway. You'll hear no argument from me on that score, Wolf agreed gamely. Would y'all shut the fuck up? L.T. Anderson was no longer their superior, yet they snapped to attention at the sound of his snarl. Old habits were hard to break. Old training? That was even harder. He started it. Wolf hooked a thumb in Romeo's direction. Romeo gasped in mock outrage. You know what, Wolf? Today we're making fuck you pie. You take a cup of piss off, add a dash of get bent, and throw in some go take a flying leap. You'll want to give that a good stir, then take a big old spoonful and shove it straight up your ass. Wolf pulled in his lips, but couldn't stop the laughter that bubbled inside his chest. That ridiculous recipe was enough to dull the edges of his bad mood. He thanked Romeo by offering him a pseudo-salute. Romeo, clearly tickled by his own sophomoric wit, smiled so wide his black goatee became little more than a frame around a mouthful of white teeth. I'll never understand how you guys spent years running missions and maintaining covers when you have the emotional maturity of 14-year-olds, LT's wife, Olivia, said with a roll of her eyes. It's a talent to be sure, Romeo conceded, at the same time LT complained. Hey, you're not lumping me in with these jackasses, are you?
Never.
Olivia pulled off LT's aviator sunglasses and planted a loud, smacking kiss on his lips. When she leaned back, there was so much love in her eyes, Wolf's own heart ached something fierce. Will a woman ever look at me the way Olivia looks at LT? Of their own accord, his eyes tracked back to Chrissy. He knew the instant she felt his gaze. The skin over her jaw tightened. Instead of looking back at him, however, she made a face of disgust at the newlyweds.
Ugh, get a room, you two.
We have one, Olivia grinned. It's right upstairs. Chrissy pretended to pout. Are you trying to make me jealous? I haven't had a date and... She shook her head. I can't remember when.
Weren't you supposed to go on a date with this one?
Olivia hooked a thumb Wolf's way.
Yeah, but it didn't work out.
That much we all know. Olivia narrowed her eyes. What we don't know is why.
Wasn't meant to be, I guess.
Chrissy shrugged, unwilling to expand on the subject. Wolf supposed he should thank her for that. And maybe he would thank her if she'd ever let him talk about it. But every time he brought it up, she lifted a hand and said, No, it's water under the bridge.
Curiouser and curiouser.
LT tapped his chin.
Not really.
Chrissy crossed her arms a little defensively, which made her cleavage deepen. Wolf guessed if he dragged his tongue up that valley, it would be as soft as satin and taste like sunscreen. The thought had his blood rising so quickly he had to adjust his stance. Romeo noticed and snorted loudly. Then he leaned in close to whisper in Wolf's ear,
Bruh. I bet your palms are as chafed as a teenage boy who's been left home alone with unlimited access to the internet, huh?
Wolf held back from punching Romeo in the beanbags.
You're a dickhead, Romeo.
Romeo countered with,
Profanity is the product of a lazy mind. You stole that from Spencer W. Kimball. And what he said was, profanity is the effort of a
Sample complete. Ready to continue?